It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, a court ruling on unpaid internships is reopening the argument over internships in the wake of a recent class action lawsuit. We'll talk to an advocate who is at the center of that lawsuit.
First, last week on the show, we talked about a new report from the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project that looked at environmental issues in Kewaunee County stemming from, it said, large farming operations there. Authors of the report, one of whom we talked to last week, say weak regulatory oversight has allowed large-scale farms to, quote, spiral out of control, ultimately pollute groundwater without consequences.
The report focuses on 16 large dairy and beef farms, including Kennard Farms in the town of Lincoln, which environmental groups accuse of causing the worst pollution. Those groups are now looking for an intervention from the EPA, asking for a stop to the farm's expansion plans, among other things. But farmers like Lee Kennard are speaking out and fighting the report's claims, saying they don't match up with the facts.
Lee Kennard is with us now. He owns and operates Kennard Farms in the town of Lincoln. Lee, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Robin. Thanks for having me and giving me a little opportunity to speak today.
Yeah, so out of 16 farms that this report calls out, Kennard Farms seems to be the target of a lot of the allegations related to pollution here. What's your response, first of all, to the claims that this report made against you and your farms?
Well, Rob, first I'd like to back up just a little bit and tell you a little bit about ourselves. Kennard Farms is a family-owned dairy here in Lincoln Township in Kewaunee County. We're a multi-generation dairy farm. Sustainably farming the land is in our genes, literally. We farm land that has been farmed by our great-grandparents as well as our parents. This is our home, Rob. We very much pride ourselves in our farmland and the fact that we live and work here. And I guess another important thing to really understand about Kennard Farms, our family and our farming practices, is that, yes, we do love our community. We enjoy being a part of a very strong agricultural heritage up here in Kewaunee County. We have been singled out in this report, and indeed, absolutely do not agree with the findings nor the allegations.
So in a statement your farm released, you say, quote, dairy is one of the most regulated and inspected industries in agriculture, end quote. Can you tell us more about that and the kind of regulations you comply with in your operations?
Yes. Being one of the larger farms in the state of Wisconsin, you are considered a CAFO, which is a concentrated animal feeding operation. So basically, what that means is any farm in the state of Wisconsin, or the United States for that matter, consisting of more than 750 milk cows, or about 750 cows, period, is given the deepest scrutiny and must abide by the most stringent regulations. Basically, we have to answer to the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, and the EPA. Part of that answering involves doing a detailed report on a yearly basis, absolutely stating that our nutrients produced, the manure, is indeed very effectively recycled back into a growing crop. Those reports are exceedingly, exceedingly detailed, science-based. We use agronomists, we use land-grant universities, we use information from the departments themselves to formulate this information and to produce this report. The report details not only our soil samples going in to the year, but indeed the crop rotation. It details exactly precisely how many nutrients will be needed to grow that crop. And indeed, it also details precisely at what time nutrients can be applied and in what manner. So it is a very detailed, very scientifically based piece of a living document.
Now, that report we talked about last week by the environmental group, the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project, said the regulations are there, they require it, but the DNR just doesn't have the staffing to do hands-on inspections. In effect, they're taking your reporting at its word. Do there need to be more DNR inspections, hands-on operations from the DNR to make sure that what's in that report you just described is what's happening literally on the ground?
Actually, anybody who would say that is not at all familiar with the nutrient management report or the methodology that goes into it. Again, We are submitted not only to regular checks, routine checks, spot checking that indeed we are following the nutrient management plan to the letter, but we are also submitted to frequent spot checks. And on our side of the world, you know, the perception that we don't care is absolutely a false one. We go well above and beyond to ensure that our nutrients are effectively being recycled. Things like tissue testing of growing crops, it's an absolute great check system. It's a check and balance saying that if we've applied a product to the ground, we can absolutely, with 100% assurance, find whether or not that is removed from the ground at that point.
We're talking to Lee Kennard. He owns and operates Kennard Farms in the town of Lincoln. He's responding to allegations in a report we talked about last week, claiming that operations like his, larger livestock operations, have a connection to water pollution in Kewaunee County. And let's get to that. There are, Lee, drinking water concerns in parts of your county, wells testing positive for unwanted bacteria, people reporting undrinkable water. Do you think there is any connection between manure runoff in the county and those water concerns?
You know, first of all, I'd like to even back up a little bit on the water quality reports. You know, I had the chance to attend. Obviously, we're quite interested in these also. Literally had the chance just last week to attend a presentation on water quality in Kewaunee County put on by Kevin Mazarek, a specialist in groundwater quality across the state. Kevin's findings were literally that Kewaunee County water fares pretty well. Actually, it is average or above average in quality compared to the rest of the state. Kevin was also very definitive in defining that, hey, there are multiple reasons that groundwater can be tainted. And really, it's very much everybody's responsibility to ensure that it is not, that it remains clean, safe, drinkable. You know, he did point to the possibility of agriculture, either animal agriculture or commercial fertilizer. But he also did say, you know, there are many other factors, sewage systems. You know, in fact, one of the things he stated is farmland. The nutrient management plan is indeed designed to utilize all the nutrients produced. A sewage system, septic system, in fact, is not. So, you know, going back to take-home message was water quality in Kewaunee County is actually as good or better than anywhere in the state.
I want to dig deeper into the nutrient management issues. I mean, when we're talking about thousands of cows, you're talking about a lot of manure. You're saying it gets used in agriculture, but there's weather, unpredictable weather factors. Rain might cause runoff. I mean, how do you, in your nutrient management plan, effectively make sure that all of those nutrients from the manure ends up not going into the groundwater?
Rob, that's actually a fairly easy thing to do. Again, you are only ever applying a nutrient in an amount needed by a growing crop, and again, confirming what you've applied has been used by the crop. Yes, weather conditions can absolutely have an impact, but the nutrient management plan is designed not only to regulate how much nutrient goes down, it absolutely also regulates such things as erosion. It spells out very clearly weather conditions in which you are not allowed to put nutrients down. It is a very restrictive document, living document, that really does a great job of protecting our environment.
There's been general concern in your county, elsewhere in the state, elsewhere in the country, that some livestock operations are just too big, too concentrated to be able to safely manage manure output, other concerns, smell, transportation, lots of things, a long list. People making these objections prefer to see lots more smaller farms. How do you respond to that general concern about CAFOs or larger livestock operations?
Well, you know, again, that's a public perception. CAFOs have come about because of the workload the commitment required to dairy farm. Dairy farming is a 365-day-a-year thing. There are no sick days. We're really hitting a crisis here in Wisconsin and nationwide. We've got a very aging population of farmers with the younger generation just not interested in coming back and doing what mom and dad did because they don't see it as ever having a day off. They don't see it as being a compatible lifestyle to other avenues that they can pursue. One of the great things that Kewaunee County farmers have been especially successful at is retaining the youth, getting our youngsters back to the farm. They've done that through size and through technology. Actually, the manure handling practices that come along with size are far better than manure handling technology of just a generation ago. And it is only through size that you can justify using this technology. It's just cost prohibitive for a smaller operator to do.
Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, I appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
That was Lee Kennard. He's owner and operator of Kennard Farms in Kewaunee County. A recent ruling has given companies more leeway to use unpaid interns and also makes it harder for interns to bring lawsuits against those companies. This decision reverses an earlier case that ruled Fox Searchlight Pictures needed to pay its interns because the work they provided was the same work that a regular paid employee would do.
A plaintiff in the case and an advocate for interns, Eric Glatt, joins us now to talk about that ruling. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for your interest in the story.
So tell us again why you brought that case against Fox Searchlight Pictures initially.
So I had become aware of the fact that the Department of Labor had issued a fact sheet outlining when one is a bona fide trainee versus an employee being called an intern. You know, having seen how widespread the practice was, particularly in the film industry and other culture production industries, and it just seemed really clear to me that employers were kind of getting away with something. And no one had really tested this in court yet, despite the fact that the Department of Labor had issued these guidelines. So, you know, after a certain amount of time trying to advocate sort of outside the judicial system, I realized litigation would had the potential of bringing this practice to a heel.
And you used the phrase getting away with something. And when you were an intern, what were some of the things that you were asked to do that you felt maybe qualified as the Fox Searchlight getting away with something?
So I worked on the film Black Swan as an accounting clerk in the accounting department. And basically I did all the normal work any other accounting clerk who's being paid would do. Except on this production, they decided to call the job an internship just basically as a way to get that labor for free. And there were unpaid interns performing other similar entry-level-like jobs in other departments on the production. May have been even more than 24. I don't recall anymore. But, you know, that's kind of standard practice now, is we've created a culture around unpaid internships where we first say, well, it's students. So because they're students, it's not really labor. They're learning something. And then we say, well, they're recent graduates. They still haven't cut their teeth yet, so they're still learning something, so they're not really employees. And as long as the economy is really bad for young adults and people entering the workforce, there's always going to be this competition to get, you know, entries on your resume. And as long as employers have the, you know, a big labor market to pick from, they'll find people willing to do this out of a sense of desperation or the lack of other alternatives while they're just starting out, and basically give themselves free rein to save money.
So in that first decision from the court, the recent one, there was a definition. There was a rule put out there about how you determine who the labor benefits. Tell us about that, because it hinged on that decision.
Right. So in 2013, the district court in our case just upheld the Department of Labor guidelines. So the Department of Labor has issued a six-factor or a six-element test derived from a 1947 Supreme Court case to say when someone's really a trainee versus an employee. And the district court upheld the Department of Labor's position, upheld our position, that we were really employees and we were owed wages, at least the minimum wage. Fox appealed that decision to the Second Circuit, and about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, the Second Circuit, a panel of three judges, came back and said the lower court had it wrong, the Department of Labor has it wrong. That Supreme Court case isn't closely reflective of what unpaid interns do today, and therefore we shouldn't be bound by it, and we're going to make up our new standards. And they just basically came up with 7 non-exclusive criteria that they made up out of whole cloth, not based on anything Congress has ever said, and said, this is the test that needs to be applied, and then remanded the case back to the district court to reconsider using this new test, whether I'm owed wages or not, and my fellow plaintiffs.
And so what does this new test change?
Well, among other things, it eliminates one of the most important parts of the 6-element test, which was that the employer derives no immediate benefit from the work of the trainee. So basically, that's a core principle of the minimum wage. Once an employer is gaining something from somebody doing work for them, they have to pay the minimum wage. And as we all know, because of other activism, the minimum wage is embarrassingly low. It's a poverty-level wage that has not kept up with productivity or inflation. Asking an employer to pay that modicum wage for labor that helps them succeed in their operations doesn't seem like much to ask. But the Second Circuit doesn't apply that test. It creates this balancing of the benefits analysis, basically saying on an individual case-by-case basis, who got more, the intern or the employer? And it's that case-by-case basis that they want to now apply that will make it really hard for any interns to file class action lawsuits like ours, or like the class action lawsuits against other employers that have so far yielded over $26 million in settlements. If all circuit courts were to apply this new standard, these lawsuits that have so far been the only effective means of providing any stopgap to what employers can and can't do, they'll be dealt a severe setback.
We're talking right now with Eric Glatt, intern advocate, plaintiff in a legal case advocating fair pay for unpaid interns. And Eric, what about thinking about that intern-employer relationship? Some people might say that it's a symbiotic relationship, that the intern gets something by being there, learning, seeing things. The employer gets things because they do maybe get some help with their goals as well. So how do you navigate that?
Well, but that's been an element of the labor market for a long, long time, before the rise of unpaid internships. Entry-level employees learn something. Even experienced employees learn something when they get promoted or they're given a new assignment. That as an aspect of employment, of having a job, I mean, that just goes with the territory. We always learn things. The idea that suddenly entry-level jobs are completely outside the scope of labor because you're learning a little bit more than you would once you have more experience under your belt, I mean, that's a policy decision. It's not reflected in the law. Congress has never said anything to that effect. The only times Congress has ever weighed in on questions about learning on the job, like for apprenticeships or the sub-minimum wage for teenagers, for student learners, those all include pay. So Congress has never really come forward and said, oh, here's a whole area where the work you do is going to be so outweighed by what you get out of it because you're relatively inexperienced that you don't deserve pay anymore. That's a policy decision. I mean, it's really my hope that these lawsuits bring the practice to a heel so we can finally have a policy conversation about what a responsible practice would look like rather than this ad hoc free-for-all in which colleges are complicit but not providing any oversight, and employers basically count on the fact that a young person starting off their career is not going to challenge them in court. They have too much at stake, and the employers, you know, sort of have the upper hand.
So you do want to start this cultural conversation. So do you think there is a place for unpaid internships at all?
I actually think that the Department of Labor standards, if they were applied properly, wouldn't be that bad, except for the fact that even if you apply those standards, it excludes from the labor market, from all these positions, people who can't afford to work for free. Most unpaid internships happen during the summer. So if you don't come from a family with the means to support you while you're working full-time without pay, those options aren't available to you. There's cases of one woman who came to Congress to intern in Harry Reid's office, and she was from a modest background and couldn't afford to live in one of the world's most expensive cities, and she went to Indiegogo. And, you know, that looks like, oh, technology coming to save the day. But really, I mean, she was begging for money in order to be able to afford this opportunity. Now, I would imagine most people in her position, equally qualified to be an intern working in a senator's office, if they can't afford to move to D.C., they're just simply not going to apply.
And Eric, thank you so much for joining us and catching us up.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
That was Eric Glatt, intern advocate and plaintiff in a legal case advocating fair pay for unpaid interns. First, an investigation out today from USA Today and Gannett newspapers comes to a startling conclusion. Despite numerous pleas from victims and promises from politicians, tens of thousands of rape kits across the United States remain untested. These kits contain forensic evidence collected from survivors of rape, and testing them can provide evidence to identify suspects and bolster prosecutions.
The backlog is a problem here in Wisconsin, and according to our next guest, police across the state are working to prioritize testing of 6,000 sexual assault kits, some of which have sat unexamined for years.
Joining us now is Keegan Kyle. He's a reporter with the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. Keegan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the number there, 6,000 untested rape kits in Wisconsin. How did you get to that number?
Well, that number comes from a first-of-its-kind survey that was done by the State Department of Justice last year and represents about 80% of law enforcement agencies in the state.
So 80% means 20% did not report. So I guess that number could be higher.
Exactly. That was part of our new reporting this year, was to go back to some of those agencies that did not report and to try to get numbers from them as well.
Now, do you have a sense of how Wisconsin's number compares to the rest of the country?
Well, USA Today found that there were more than at least 70,000 of these untested sexual assault kits across the country. So relatively speaking to our population, we're not a huge amount or a little amount, but we are like a pretty significant chunk.
And when you think about something like this, you might think that you'll get these big numbers from big metro areas, but this investigation found that there were also relatively high numbers of untested kits in rural places, in smaller city departments. How did that play out in Wisconsin?
Well, an example of that would be like the city of Green Bay. So, you know, untested sexual assault kits is not a new issue for Wisconsin or the country. And largely, a lot of the public scrutiny has been focused on these huge police departments like Milwaukee or New York or Detroit. And places like Green Bay or Appleton or Wausau, you know, have not faced the same type of scrutiny to go in and look at how many untested kits there are and to start, you know, evaluating whether they needed to do something about them.
Was Green Bay the highest number of untested kits in the state?
No, that would still be Milwaukee.
That is still Milwaukee.
But, you know, what's unusual about Green Bay is that relative to the city of their size, they do have a large number compared to their population. So there is kind of a question there about how that number has amassed over the years.
It was interesting to read that in some cases, these police departments were not even certain where these kits were being stored. They were in different places. There didn't seem to be protocols in place. What does this say about the organization and the procedure surrounding rape kits?
Yeah, I think part of the challenge about trying to get a count on the number of kits is that, especially in smaller police departments, there aren't a lot of rigorous mechanisms in place to kind of keep track and evidence. And so last year when like the state went to all these agencies and said, please count your kits, you know, that literally required some officers to go into these giant refrigerators and to look through boxes and investigative files and try to come up with some type of count. You know, there was no database of barcodes that they could look up or some type of report that they could quickly look up. And that's now an issue this year as they're going back to all those cases and trying to classify them and figure out which ones need to be tested.
And in terms of figuring out which ones need to be tested, how do police departments start to prioritize that? You've got a backlog. You can't test them all at once. So how do you go through and decide which ones should come first?
The state is still kind of figuring that out, but there's they've already set in place kind of a three-tiered priority system. In that first tier are kits that have a very immediate need in court. You know, like there's a court date coming up and they need to get that evidence tested for a mainly procedural reason. Second, there are cases where there's 6-year statute of limitations is coming up. And if they don't get that kit tested and, you know, identify a suspect, that they could miss, you know, putting someone behind bars. Third is really gets more into the details of the case. So looking at which kits are most likely to identify a suspect or going to be most valuable to an investigation. You know, I talked with a lot of police agencies for this story, and an example of a type of kit that is viewed as not as valuable are cases where, you know, the person who the kit was taken from has already said they don't want to be part of the criminal justice system, they don't want to proceed with charges, or they've kind of recanted their story and said, you know, I am not saying that I was assaulted. Those are the types of cases that police are now trying to sort through as well and to figure out where do all these pieces fit together.
We're talking right now with Keegan Kyle, a reporter with the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team, talking about a new report on untested rape kits here in Wisconsin. And in terms of the cost that we're talking about here, 6,000 untested rape kits, how much does it cost to process these and actually test them?
Well, each kit, it's not cheap, first of all. Each kit is about $1,000. So looking at, you know, Wisconsin's estimated 6,000 cases, we're talking about in the range of $6 million to try to erase all of these cases. That's part of the equation about why the state is looking at these cases so carefully, is because they want to try to figure out which ones are most in need of actually being tested and spending that money to get them tested immediately, and which cases maybe don't need to be tested, in which case the state could save some money.
Now, it's worth talking about why these matter, because we started to hear, as this comes into public consciousness, that the term rape kit, it sounds a little bit clinical, a little bit removed, but tell us why they matter.
Well, this has been a really great debate within law enforcement and within the larger community about what types of kits should be tested, which should be sent to the state crime lab. And within law enforcement, there's a lot of debate about this because, one, cost is a factor. And two, if you're testing these kits, you know, that can potentially delay other types of evidence. On the other hand, this growing national databases we have of DNA has shown that there are advantages to testing all types of kits, especially in the cases of where you have attackers who work, for lack of a better term, across jurisdictions. And so police can kind of piece together through these kits how someone might be a serial offender across both in Wisconsin and, let's say, Illinois or Minnesota. And even cases where, you know, you might think that you only have a single incident that you're really looking at. Only when you test these cases are you maybe possibly going to get a hit in a DNA database that reveals a much broader picture. And that's been kind of one of the driving reasons why the state is re-looking at all these cases. Even cases where, you know, victims do not want to be part of the criminal justice system, or it's unclear that a crime actually occurred, police are looking at those cases for possibly being tested because it might help piece together this larger picture using DNA databases.
Is there a plan here in Wisconsin to try to get 100% reporting from departments across the state?
Maybe. I'm not sure. You'd have to double check that with the DOJ, but I know that they are going back this year to all of the agencies, even the ones that didn't respond, and are trying to get a better count on how many cases there are, and also to classify all the cases that are out there in this priority system that they're creating.
And Keegan, what's the plan going forward for Wisconsin for getting some of these tested? You talked about priorities, but is there some sort of timeline?
Yeah, the state hopes in the next few months to wrap up kind of classifying all these cases, and then hopefully by the end of the year they can start to schedule you know, actual cases for being tested. And it's not going to be like, you know, one huge dump where all 6,000 cases get sent to the state crime lab. Again, it's going to be kind of in this tiered order of trying to do prioritize cases that have the most urgent needs.
Are there any success stories of cities in Wisconsin that have been effective at reducing the backlog?
That's a little unclear. You know, one agency that we highlighted in our story was the Milwaukee Police Department, which last year reported to the state that it had 2,600 cases. And then when we filed a records request this year, told us it had about 1,600. We contacted the department to talk more about that, but just weren't able to get in touch before our deadline today. Other places, the numbers are also in a little bit of a fluctuation. You know, these reports and surveys represent kind of a snapshot in time. So last year, Green Bay, for instance, you know, reported to the state that it was around 320 cases. And then this year reported that it was up to 350, 360. But there are other departments that are a little bit more, or it's not, like I said, I think the issue is that police departments don't have this rigorous tracking system. So in some cases, like the Wausau Police Department, for example, last year they reported that they had 112 cases. But when we went back to them this year to talk about that, they reported that actually the number was about a third of that. And they kind of mistakenly took the state survey to mean that they wanted to get a count of all kits within their lockers, not only untested ones. So this may be a long way of saying that the picture is not as clear as you might hope, in that actually measuring, you know, is the backlog increasing or decreasing is a little trickier than you might think.
Keegan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Keegan Kyle, a reporter with the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. His story on untested rape kits in Wisconsin was just released this afternoon. We've got a link to that story on the Central Time Facebook page.
Earlier this week, we talked about a story here on the show that stirred up some real debate. Here's what happened. Recently, the Cooking Channel asked its viewers to pick a distinctive food for every state in the union. You might see where this is going, the kind of controversy that could rise from this.
Here in Wisconsin, well, we ended up with bratwurst stewed in sauerkraut as our signature dish. And so we asked you on social media, do you agree or do you disagree with that choice? Needless to say, a ton of comments came in, so we thought, maybe we've got a little bit more to discuss here, to hash out.
So we're going to open up the phones to you now at 800-642-1234. What do you think should be the signature dish of Wisconsin? What if you had to explain Wisconsin to someone from another state, what food would you use to do so? Do you say yay or nay to this idea of bratwurst stewed in sauerkraut? What other culinary creations do you think have come to define Wisconsin? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Okay, so here's my issue with this whole bratwurst stewed in sauerkraut. It's the stewed in sauerkraut.
It's specific.
Who actually does that?
Oh, so I mean, I've done it
you
on the grill.
Stew it?
Well, on the grill, and you put it in a pan with the sauerkraut. And so, speaking of debates, people are debating the best way. We talked about this on the Joy Cardine show once, and every single caller had a different right way to make the bratwurst, and that was one of them. But that's the thing. That's the problem. There's lots
of
ways
being
to do
grilled.
It. Grilled, fried. There's
well,
a lot of ways to do it.
Maybe boiled and then grilled or whatever you do to make them extra juicy.
But I agree with the specificity. I'm with you on this one.
Okay, you agree about that. But further to that, I say forget brats and go for the squeaky cheese curd. And you know who else agrees? Angela on Facebook.
Yep, yeah, that would have been her choice. So Wendy on Facebook says frozen custard. Hard to argue with. I mean, frozen custard is new to people, I think. It was new to me when I moved to Wisconsin. And it's good. It's a good thing. Well, we've got callers at 800-642-1234 asking you what is the distinctive food of Wisconsin. We'll start with Matt in Kashina. Matt, hi.
Hi. Well, I come from the Menominee Indian Reservation, and the translation of Menominee is the wild rice people, because we harvested that. Now, what would be more ingrained in Wisconsin than that?
And Matt, and now it's not just native people in Wisconsin. I mean, I think a lot of people look forward to finding that wild rice stand, driving around up north and cooking with it. So I think you've got a good case here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Matt, thanks for getting us started looking for your signature foods of Wisconsin at 800-642-1234. Wild rice is one I hadn't thought of. That's, I think that's a
good
idea.
Yeah, that's an excellent one and a very tasty one. I think that's an excellent one. And it's, we've been chatting with Michelle, our technical director, mm-hmm. about this, and she says we don't just need a food. We need an entire meal, and the meal should be fish fry.
Ooh, that's a good case to make. Yeah, we'll be talking about fish fry tomorrow on Food Friday, by the way. But yeah, that's, again, it's one where other places have fish fry, but I don't think anybody has fish fry to the extent that Wisconsin has fish fry.
It's every Friday.
It's a cultural institution here.
And
that I don't think
one.
It is elsewhere.
Right.
And I threw into the mix a supper club favorite, the relish tray. Again, a thing that was new to me when I came here, and there's different ways to do them. You got some vegetables, you got the cheese to dip in.
Radishes, I think of.
Breadstick.
Breadsticks.
Yeah.
And the cheese.
And the cheese comes
cheese
back into
key.
It everywhere.
Definitely. Well, I think that's creative. I like the relish tray idea. Okay, let's go to our next caller. Lynn is joining us now in Madison. Lynn, hi.
Oh, hi. Oh, dear. Traffic, rain, and I'm on the phone.
Oh, no. Be careful.
Actually, I'd like to suggest a meal rather than a dish because I think it's sort of like a quilt or a mosaic rather than one size fits all.
Uh-huh.
And the last couple callers said a couple of my suggestions, or the last few, which would be certainly brats and kraut, definitely wild rice. I love the cheese. And then let's get some good vegetables and things like nettles and some of the things that
Ooh.
Grow here.
Oh, it sounds like a very
own.
Balanced
like maybe
meal.
A great big salad.
Okay, thank you. Lynn wants it all. She doesn't want to give up any of it. She wants it all in a big meal or a salad.
I mean, it sounds like a great meal, but yeah, I mean, and I'll take that, a signature meal, but it's hard to get all that on the map that we had posted on the Central Time Facebook page. They wanted one graphic of one food,
yeah,
so,
good point.
So we got the brat there.
We might run into spatial constraints, but thank you, Lynn. Appreciate that call, and we're going to go next to Dennis in Galesville. Dennis, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm not at all opposed to a brat and kraut, but I really love a pot roast with onions and carrots and potatoes and anything fresh out of the garden.
So you think that that pot roast with onions and potatoes is more Wisconsin, or do you just think it's tastier?
Well, I think it's very much rural Wisconsin.
Okay.
I mean, that's how I grew up. I'm sure it's not much modern day, but
a lot of us
still love them.
Great. Well, thanks for bringing that up. That's an interesting one. I'd be interested to hear if other folks in rural Wisconsin think that, yes, pot roast says Wisconsin.
And I bet a lot of people would, but that's what I think you'd have an equal interest in a lot of states. It's not as uniquely Wisconsin as brat-related, cheese-related, wild rice-related things. So definitely it's something that's eaten here, but okay, thanks. I like that suggestion, though, Dennis. So we'll go next to Kevin with us in Park Falls. Kevin, hi.
Yeah, all of the great suggestions, but the one thing, you know, we get visitors from all over the country and all over the world. When we give them deep-fried cheese curds, they say, this is the only place we've ever had them, and they're fantastic.
Are you a deep-fried cheese curd fan yourself, Kevin?
I've imbibed a few. They usually go well with a couple beers,
mine
and Google's, especially.
Kevin, thank you so much. And I think there's a good case to be made there because I have had relatives come in and insist on finding a place that could provide them with these deep fried cheese curds that they'd heard about, not encountered elsewhere. So that is distinctively Wisconsin, not distinctively Wisconsin health food, but definitely something that you don't really see elsewhere.
Right. Well, that's a great one. Thanks for that. And on we go to Joe in Beaver Dam. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. How about you?
I'm doing all right. I'm enjoying the rain.
Mm. And what do you want to eat in the rain in Wisconsin?
You know, as I was telling the other guy, I really like, I think, Wiener Schnitzel because of Wisconsin's German heritage and whatnot.
Remind me what exactly Wiener Schnitzel is. I know it's something that's breaded and breaded and pan fried, but what is...
Yeah, it's normally a pork cutlet. You know, they'll pound it really nice and thin and bread it and deep fry it and serve it with, like, spatzel, which is kind of like a dumpling. And some braised red cabbage.
It's traditionally done like that.
That sounds pretty okay. Joe, thanks for that recommendation, Wiener Schnitzel. And I'd add to that, I'll see his Wiener Schnitzel and I'll raise him potato pancakes.
Oh, potato pancakes too. Wow, both of you are making me really hungry here. I love Spätzle, and Spätzle goes really well with any pork product I find. So that's, and the German heritage, definitely a lot of unique Wisconsin there. Joe, thanks for your call. We are taking your nominations for what should be considered the distinctive food item of Wisconsin. It all started with brats and sauerkraut. We're getting your suggestions now at 800-642-1234 or at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go next to Doug in Green Bay. Doug, hi there.
Hi there. In Wisconsin, you go to a church picnic and you never fail. They have booyah, burgers, brats, and beer. It should be a country western song. Booyah. Booyah is Wisconsin all the way. Everybody talks about how they make it, how long they cook it, what are the ingredients they put in there, including oxtail.
And Doug, remind us, for the uninitiated, what is booyah?
Yeah, I love it when people ask that, because it's like, yeah, there, hey, up north there, you would have had that booyah, you know? Booyah, it's chicken booyah, soup. It's some places, they take 12 to 16 hours to cook up a batch. Some of them can cook it up in 3 hours. The ingredients, everybody argues about whose recipes are the best, but it's up here, it's Wisconsin all the way.
Booyah is to northern Wisconsin as gumbo is to Louisiana, as I understand it. Thank you. That's another great one for the distinctive Wisconsin food
list,
Doug.
Awesome. I've never heard of that.
I've heard of it, but mostly from our listeners. I have not personally tried it.
Is it on restaurant menus or is it a cook-at-home thing?
Michelle Good, who's from up there, is nodding intensely. You can get it at restaurants in Minocqua,
really?
Michelle?
Green Bay.
So I've just gone to the wrong Green Bay restaurant. So I've gotten pizza up there. That's not distinctively Green Bay.
No. All right, let's go back to our callers. Thanks a lot for that. Ryan, you're next in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi, Ryan from Green Bay over here. And I got to throw it out there for the Kringle.
The Kringle. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I can't believe we haven't mentioned that yet.
Kringle, yeah, and you know, you've got a lot of great Kringle here. One of my daughters has really fallen in love with Kringle lately, so that definitely we need to have some kind of like voting or like a bracket with Wisconsin foods. I think that may be our next step here.
A taste off.
Yeah, that sounds great. One more caller, I think Jake in Baraboo is next. Jake, hi.
Hi, how we doing?
Good. What do you got, Jake?
I would agree with the brat should definitely be the state food of Wisconsin, but the only thing it should ever be stewed in is beer. Wisconsin.
Stewed in the beer, grilled in the beer. Can we put some sauerkraut on it after it's cooked, though?
Well, absolutely. That's done by taste. But this is Wisconsin. You get some good Miller product, perhaps a PBR to boil them in beforehand. You throw them on the grill.
Yeah, he's right.
That's the way it should be. This is Wisconsin.
He's right. It has to be in beer.
I think that does beat the sauerkraut one for what should be the representative food of Wisconsin. Thank you, Jake. Thanks to all of you for your calls. You can keep sharing your distinctive Wisconsin foods on the Central Time Facebook page.